Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. We're back after a one-week break to get some business in order, but rest assured, we're still the same pod and can be found mostly all the same places. Two guests this week. First up, we'll chat with UNLV Athletic Director Desiree Reed-Francois about her role in the National Coalition for Minority Football Coaches. Maryland's Mike Loxley founded the group last year, and Reed-Francois has taken an active role in trying to make it effective in its goal of getting more minority coaches at all levels of football in position to be head coaches. We'll talk to Desiree about the Coalition's Coaches Academy program that started last week. After that, we'll talk NFL Draft with Eric Edholm of Yahoo Sports. The draft begins on April 29th, and it figures to be quarterback heavy at the top of the first round. We'll ask Eric how this class of five likely first round picks compares to the 2017 class of quarterbacks. How were the opt-out prospects impacted by not playing last season? What positions are deepest and thinnest among this year's draft-eligible players? Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, just about anywhere you like to get your podcast. If you like what you hear, give us a good review and a good rating. It helps college football fans find us, and it helps us find more college football fans. If you'd like to email the show, send questions and comments to AP Top 25 Mailbag. That's AP Top 25, the numbers 25, mailbag@gmail.com, AP Top 25, mailbag@gmail.com. And away we go. Joining me this week, my first guest, is UNLV's athletic director, Desiree Reed-Francois. Desiree, thanks so much for joining us today here on the podcast. Hope things are well in Las Vegas.
Thank you so much for having me, Ralph. And yes, everything is going very well in Las Vegas.
Excellent. So wanted to talk to you specifically, and I probably get into a little bit about the Rebels, too, and how things are going with, I know the new stadium didn't go quite well like we thought last year. So I want to touch a little bit on that. But mostly I wanted to talk to you today about your role in the National Coalition of Minority Football Coaches. This is a group that Mike Loxley, the coach of Maryland, founded last year. It has a lot of great intentions behind it, but great intentions are nice. What we would like to hear about is action, right? And last week, the coalition, led by you in many ways, you're a board member, and I know you've been really pivotal in getting this launched, started a coaches academy for minority coaches. So let's talk about what actions the coalition is putting behind its, you know, very important and positive sentiments.
We know, first I should start off, this is an important cause for me. We all know what it's like to feel like an other, right? There are only 3% of athletic directors in the FBS that are women of color. So I know what it's like to feel like that. But I also know what it's like to hire coaches. And sometimes as athletic directors, we tend to hire people that we know. When you're going through a search, it's a high-pressure, high-stress process. And so you really rely upon your trusted network of colleagues and coaches that you know. And so we started this academy with the intent of, we've got great coaches out there, and we need to expand that pipeline, but we also need to provide not only context for our student-athletes. We have an imperative that our student athletes need to look at their coaches and see people like them. We need to prepare our coaches, though, so that when they're in that chair or when they're interviewing to get in that chair, they're going to be successful. And then what the coalition is trying to do by creating this mentoring program is advocate. We want to make sure that as we see prepared and talented coaches coming up, we're advocating for them so they have an opportunity to get in that head role. And then eventually, my hope is that these head coaches, once they're in that chair, these athletic director relationships that they're going to have are going to last a lot longer than just a year. This is a pilot program, and so we selected 12 coaches that we felt were kind of the next ones up, the Tony Elliott, the Josh Gaddises, Jay Norvell, Marcus Arroyo. We have some really, really talented coaches that are either relatively new in the head coaching role or are a coordinator or a position coach, an NFL coach that is talented and wants to become a head coach. And then we reached out to 12 athletic directors, and, you know, I was really – athletics, we have some really good people, and not a single one hesitated when I called and asked if they'd be part of this pilot program, and every single one said not just yes, it was a heck yes. So long answer to an important question, but this is just the first step, and I'm hoping it's the first step of many.
When you pair up the mentors and the mentees, what was the thought process behind that, and what do you hope that their interactions will produce?
Yep. Authentic relationships. And authentic relationships that can then lead to not only mentoring and helping that assistant coach or that coordinator be prepared not only for the interview but for the job, but also so that that athletic director can serve as an advocate. Like I said, when you're going through a search process, you tend to rely upon the people that you really know. Your circle is really small. And so we want to continue to grow our coordinators' circles so that they can have legitimate shots at being head coaches. But I know how much mentoring has meant to me throughout my career. And I still call my mentors, and you have almost like a personal board of directors as you go through your career, and that's what we're trying to do with this. Each of those position coaches or each of our mentees, they'll have a conversation once a month with their athletic director mentor. They also have, every month we have a meeting with that group, and we'll bring on different speakers, whether it's a communications professional, whether it's leadership, it's mental health. We bring on speakers to also keep preparing and providing more tools in their respective toolboxes so that when they have an opportunity to interview, they are prepared and they're ready. And we're going to make it so we're going to mitigate every possible reason why we shouldn't hire these talented coordinators.
Right, because you talk about that relationship between head coaches and athletic directors. And as I talk to coaches, especially younger coaches who are sort of still looking at the big prizes, I think one of the things that they are most what they're hearing and what they sort of are gaining knowledge in, but then wondering what exactly does that knowledge look like, is it's not just enough for me to understand football, right? I need to, like, you know, head coach's job is bigger than just that. So, you know, I'll leave it, you know, you have a mentee-mentor relationship. You've got paired up with a coach. What are some of the things you're trying to impart on that coach to make them understand that, okay, you may know ball, but here's some other things that you need to know to wind your way through not just the interview process, but when you get into that seat to be successful, here are some things that you need to know.
Exactly. And so great head coaches, right, they're not just a great coach, just an X's and O's coach. They're also not just a great recruiter. But when you're coming up, that's what you're becoming, you're developing an expertise in the X's and O's and recruiting. But the piece that's the difference in my mind between a hired coach and a fired coach is that CEO piece. And so as when we brought these athletic directors in, these are all great CEOs of their respective athletic departments. And so we wanted to try and have our mentees tap into their expertise, because this isn't, unless they've sat in the chair before, this is all going to be new for them. And we want to make sure that they're prepared, and let's learn from some experts. And, you know, every single one of our mentees, they're trying to get better. But you know what? Our mentors are also, and this is a great opportunity for our mentors to learn from some really talented people. So I'm excited about seeing these relationships develop and really grow. And so I have Travis Robinson, and he is at the University of Miami. And so this morning we were texting about books, and I was wondering what he was reading, and we are sharing some book suggestions. And again, that is appealing to my inner geekiness. But, you know, I think as CEOs, you know, we have to continue to expand our leadership opportunities, and we all want to keep growing.
So maybe I should have asked you this on the front end, and you've alluded to some of the reasons, but I want to ask you more directly so you can expound on it. There are currently, I believe, 20 minority head coaches in FBS out of 130 schools. I don't remember exactly what number of those are African American, but I think it's about 14 or maybe 12. Those are very low numbers, right? If you consider especially the population of the players and what that looks like, and then look at what the population of the head coaches looks like, it is off, to say the least. So again, you've alluded to some of these things, but why do you think it's clearly a problem? It's very easy to sort of stand up and say, "Oh, it's a problem with systemic racism." But what I want you to sort of describe to me is what the problem is, how to address it, and why. Why are we at this point? Why do you think? I know it's a complicated question, but why do you think we are at this point where the number of head coaches is still lagging behind the population that it is coaching?
Great question. And I think it's a really nuanced answer. But what I do know is when I stand in front of my football team, or I want to make sure that they see a head coach that actually for all of our student athletes, I want all of our student athletes to see head coaches like them. Sonia Sotomayor, who's a Supreme Court Justice, she talked about the importance of providing context. And I really believe in that. I'm pretty proud of the fact at UNLV that our head coaching group is the most diverse in our conference and top five in the country. And we're never going to hire based upon someone's race or ethnicity, orientation or gender. But we're always going to have a very diverse pool, and we're going to actively recruit people to make sure that they are reflective of what our student athletes are. And it's not just a cultural imperative, but it's just the right thing to do. And I think as we've seen this summer and even and before, and when you tell me that those numbers, when we look at those numbers, we all recognize that this is just wrong. And we all have to do our part to address it. And is the academy going to solve everything? No. But it's definitely a step in the right direction. And when you create authentic relationships and you put some smart people together, good things are going to come. So this is just one step in a full marathon. But I'm really excited about it. And I know that I am learning a lot from Coach Robinson. And last week we had our first call with mentors and mentees, and it was awesome. And you could just feel the energy, but you could also, at all the conversations I had afterwards, it was excellent, and people were really excited about this. So we're going to continue to expand those networks, make sure our folks are incredibly prepared, and then once they get in those chairs, how can we help them continue to be successful? Because our student athletes deserve that.
Right, and expanding those networks is the thing I probably is good to stress, because in talking with some African-American coaches, a lot of them come back to just that idea of you tend to hire who you know and who you are many ways, and who you know are often people who are similar to you with similar backgrounds. And what it seems like the coalition, again, actionable, something that you can actually where you can make change, is creating these opportunities for people to get to, literally and quite simply for people to get to know one another, people from different backgrounds being better at getting to know one another.
Exactly. And then, you know what, when someone like Greg Byrne or Jack Swarbrick or Jen Cohen or Barry Alvarez picks up the phone and calls and says, "Hey, you know what? Let me tell you about Tony Elliott. And I've known Tony Elliott for the last year. We talk every month. And let me tell you about his character." Because in the end, when you're hiring great coaches, character matters. And that's the first thing that we look for. And now our AD advocates can talk about Tony Elliott or Josh Gattis's character. I can talk about Coach Robinson's character. And that really matters, because I've sat on the other side of that call when I'm getting a reference from someone, and you want to be able to speak from a point of authenticity. And I think that's what this is, one step in being able to do that.
My last question to you on this is it reasonable to set a goal to say we have, I believe it's 12, right, a dozen coaches, and our goal is for at least 3 of them to be head coaches. Now, in some cases, a couple of them, including your own, is a head coach. So I'm sure you don't want Marcus going to get another job that quickly. No. But nonetheless.
No,
but
I don't want him to leave me.
Right, right.
But I do really want him to continue to have a broad base, a broad network. And I really believe in him. So I'm fortunate that Dan Radakovich, who's been phenomenal to me, is going to also provide another voice. Mm-hmm. So, but you asked about is there a goal on the numbers?
Yeah, do you set a goal, or is that not really realistic yet just because everything is so new?
It's a great question, and it is a little new, and it is a pilot program. But, you know, we all have a scoreboard at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And so do we have a set target number? No, but we're going to be tracking this, and we're doing this with a purpose. And we've got some high we ask people to get involved, and it's our responsibility to do a really good job. And part of that definition of doing a really good job is saying, okay, how successful were we? And let's look at those metrics.
I want to ask you one quick thing about where UNLV football is in particular. And you have this beautiful new stadium, Allegiant Stadium, that UNLV will call home. And of course, the pandemic hits. And listen, we all have our trials and tribulations, and we don't want to overstate what happens in the sports world compared to what has happened to our country over the last year or so. But nonetheless, I'm sure it sucked, to be quite frank, that happened to UNLV last year. I'm sure if I'm sitting in your chair, that really sucked. I know you don't woe is me, and you understand that other people have bigger issues. But when you look at the opportunity to sort of get back to normal this coming season, I guess I would ask you, what was lost last year from UNLV, and how do you recover that, and what are you most looking forward to coming into the 2021 season?
I'm really looking forward to having a season where we had a spring. We hired Coach Arroyo in December of 2019. He hits the road recruiting. He gets a number one recruiting class. Our recruiting class over the past decade has averaged, in our conference, has averaged 8, and we got our first number one recruiting class. So Coach Arroyo hit the ground running and just did a great job. And then all of a sudden, we have signing day in February, and then all of a sudden, March, our world shuts down. We all know what that meant, and that isolation, and we all know what that felt like. And so many people had it much, much worse than we did. And I know so many suffered. So I don't want to overstate the challenges. But not having a spring for a brand new team was an obstacle. But you know what? That's just an obstacle that you just got to go through. And Marcus and the team did a great job of coming together. He was phenomenal as a first-year head coach and putting safety first. I don't think he did anything without us working together with our team doctors and our state epidemiologist. And I was really proud of the way that they handled the pandemic and keeping our student athletes engaged, making sure that they were cared for, and that they felt like that what we were doing was always in their best interest. And so now what I'm really excited about is where I think we're on day 12, and so I think today is an install day, and it's exciting because Marcus and his whole staff are able to really have a spring, and we have another great recruiting class. That recruiting class was number 2 in the conference, and again, like I said, we had averaged 8 over the last decade. So the future is really bright. We have our brand new Fertitta football complex, which is stunning. It's the best in the West, and that opened in October of the year before in 2019. So we have the tools in place, we have the right leader, and the future is really bright.
Okay, and I should clarify, UNLV did play in that stadium last year. In fact, had a few fans late in the season in that stadium. In fact, Is it possible you were one of the first fan event in that stadium?
We were. We got it was awesome. We got to have 2,000 fans, and then we had 1,000 fans, And now I cannot wait when we open in September and have a full stadium. So it's going to be very, very special. It is Allegiant Stadium. It's state of the art. It's a $2 billion stadium. And Sam Boyd was wonderful, but it was about 20 miles away from our campus. And right now I'm looking out over at the strip from my office and I can see our new stadium. And so it's right there. You're on the electric strip and it's going to be open and it's going to be exciting. And I can't wait to see people. And there's something so special and galvanizing about a group of people coming together to cheer on a team. So I'm fired up for September.
Excellent. And the opening game will be, is it Eastern Washington? Is that the opener on a Thursday night?
Yes, it is. It is. I'm excited to welcome Eastern Washington to Allegiant Stadium.
Excellent. Well, Desiree Reed-Francois is the athletic director at UNLV. She is also a board member and key contributor to the Coalition of Minority Football Coaches, a group founded by Mike Loxley. Very much involved there. Desiree, thank you so much for joining us here today on the podcast, giving us a little insight on the coalition and a little update on UNLV football. Good luck. Good luck with everything. This season isn't even over yet. You know, we think of sometimes that, you know, football season's over, basketball season's over, things are easy, but you still have some sports going on. So good luck to UNLV in all your sports, and hopefully we get back to a normal football season in 2021.
Thank you so much, Ralph. I appreciate you having me on.
If you like what you hear, give us a good review and a good rating. It helps college football fans find us, and it helps us find more college football fans. If you'd like to email the show, send questions and comments to AP Top 25 Mailbag. That's AP Top 25, the numbers 25, mailbag at gmail.com, AP Top 25 Mailbag at gmail.com. Joining me next on the podcast is Eric Edholm. He is the draft analyst, reporter, and all-around good guy for Yahoo Sports. Have a couple of draft previews, actually, because everybody loves the draft. So we're doing something with Eric this week, and we'll do a little more next week before we get into the draft. But this is probably going to be a little more nuts and bolts about what's going on with this year's draft, because it gives people a little longer to listen to the podcast and catch up and know where they need to stand going into April 29th. Eric, first of all, thanks for joining me first time on the pod.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you for reaching out. I appreciate that.
So, you know, one of the places I like to start is before we get into who's going to go where and who's your best quarterback, we'll get into all that, all those things, is sort of a big picture look at the draft. And that is from this angle. You know, how many players, when you look at this, is this a deep draft? Is this a draft where, you know, by the time you get to the middle of the first round, you're already looking at guys who might have some second round grades? Or is it a, hey, by the time you get to early second round, you might still be able to, the numbers show, as far as you look at the grades, that you might still be able to get first round talent in the early second round? Give me some idea of what the depth of the draft is.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an unusual year, in my opinion. Obviously, you know, the big topic, and I'm sure, you know, people want to hear about, are the quarterbacks. And we could set records for quarterbacks at the top of the draft. But on the flip side, defensively, you know, there is no Chase Young. There is no Nick Bosa. So it's a little weaker at the top defensively. And, you know, to your first-round grade question, you know, when I kind of poll NFL people, okay, how many first-round grades did you give out? It's not 32 for every team, obviously, and it's almost never close to that number, as I'm sure you know, and maybe some people know out there. But, you know, typically the number comes in somewhere between 15 and 25, let's say, in terms of clubs giving out a number of first-round grades. That means that teams picking at the bottom of round one usually are taking players with second-round grades, though not always. And so I had 20 myself, and my list is comprised based on my own observations, but also based on, you know, multiple conversations over the last 6 or 8 months. So, you know, from that standpoint, I think it's pretty good near the top, except for the defensive concerns that I mentioned. But, you know, there's some positions that I think are really deep, and I think there are some that are really thin. And just the big picture, I would guess that this pool of 6th, 7th round picks and undrafted players might be on the weaker side. We saw a number of players, you know, opt to come back to school, and you know, the number of players looking for agents is lower than it's ever been. So You know, it does feel like the depth, even at the stronger positions, does drop off after a certain point.
You know, so I'm a big fantasy baseball player guy. And when you do your fantasy teams, and maybe you do this in football too, I don't write, do football quite as much, is tiers, right? We do tiers. If I can't get this first baseman, boy, I'm going to be, then there's a big drop off. So when you talk about tiers at the top here, you know, again, it's almost hard. We've gotten so quarterback-centric that it's almost hard to sort of look at tiers for the total pool because quarterbacks tend to get overdrafted. But can you find a tier, like what is like sort of the top tier of this draft? This is where the star players are. This is where the players I believe will be stars. This is where that ends. So not just first-round grades, but sort of that elite talent. Where does that pool end?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a hard one to determine because obviously, you know, does Trey Lance belong in that group, you know, who with 17 starts at the FCS level? Some would say yes. Some might have a little more reservation. So the quarterback element especially makes that answer a little thornier. But and then with the opt-outs too, obviously, you know, Penei Sewell, you know, and Rashawn Slater looked tremendous in 2019. Did a year off hurt them? Would they have played better or the same or worse in 2020? What would their, you know, draft grade have been? So there's definitely more risk factor in this, but I would guess that the top tier probably ends somewhere about the point where J.C. Horn goes off the board. I know that's sort of a random name to pluck out the son of Joe Horn, but I sort of think that that's kind of the top 12, 13, 14 picks, I would say. Again, allowing for your normal allotment of misses and all that. But, you know, so that's your Trevor Lawrence's, your Kyle Pitts, your Penei Sewell's, Jamar Chase, Jalen Waddle, et cetera. And then once I think you get to like Patrick Surtain, J.C. Horn, that sort of region, I think you're starting to look more for the very good football players who maybe don't have elite athleticism or elite skill level, but are very solid and have high floors, or you're looking for the guy with skill, but boy, he's got some off the field concerns and medical issues or what have you. And that's where I think the questions really start coming up is probably after about the first third or two fifths of the first round, that 12 to 15 range is where I start getting a little more nervous.
Okay, I want to get back to the positions at some point, but you opened up the window there to talk about the opt-out players. The most prominent ones are Penei Sewell, the Oregon tackle, Jamar Chase, the wide receiver from LSU, Micah Parsons, the linebacker from Penn State, probably Rashawn Slater, the offensive tackle from Northwestern. If I'm missing anybody, I think those are the most prominent ones. Are there any players that you can you feel like may have lost some value by not playing, simply by not playing? Or did you kind of come away thinking like, you know what? These guys, yes, they were stuck in time, so they didn't necessarily, they couldn't necessarily improve their stock. But if I look back at where I would have had these guys going into last year or going into the season, it doesn't look like any of them hurt themselves all that much. I know that's a hard thing to judge, but when you sort of look at those opt-out players, especially those top tier, how do you think they did?
Yeah, you're right. I think a lot of the people who graded, you know, Chase and Sewell and those types of players at the very top of the draft, Parsons will put to the side for a moment. But the other, you know, pretty much the other guys that you just mentioned, I would say, you know, it's not like their stocks have been unassailable, but most people are keeping them roughly in the same region that they are now. You know, there hasn't been any depreciation of value. So, you know, for those guys, the decisions were pretty clear cut at the time. They seem to have been the right decisions now in retrospect. With Parsons, there's been some digging on his character, and I think there'll be some teams who say, yeah, he's a top 10 talent, but we're sort of projecting him based on 1 year linebacker. And there are also some off the field quick concerns that we may have, you know, just, there was some, you know, there was that allegation of the bullying scandal
there.
I know
right.
some people have cast doubts on it and all that, but getting answers to those questions has been important. So for players who don't have either a medical issue, like a Caleb Farley, let's say, who just went under a second back surgery and I, you know, would have been a top 10 or 15 pick, prior to that, and then the character guys like Parsons, a lot of the top ones have remained unscathed. But I kind of look at, you know, Greg Rousseau from Miami, 15 and a half sacks.
Yeah, he was the other one I was going to bring up.
Yeah.
Basically a one-year player because he played a very little bit in his redshirt freshman year, and that was pretty much about it.
That's right. That's exactly it. And, you know, you saw him win more often sometimes from the inside, or at least more frequently on a per-snap basis, and you think to yourself, you know, does he need to put on weight and become Calais Campbell, or does he become an edge rusher over time and refinement, you know? If so, what teams are going to be willing to take that on in round one, as alluring as his, you know, upside appears to be? That's, you know, he's somebody I would say that maybe hurt himself in the long run, and I think could have done, you know, better for himself. But he made a decision, and obviously there's some real good stuff in his evaluation. But, you know, a couple of defensive tackles too. Tyler Shelvin at LSU, Jay Tufele at USC, probably Jalen Twyman at Pitt. This is not a good year for defensive tackles, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys still don't seem to be cracking the upper reaches of that spot. So outside of the sort of no question first round picks, some of the decisions may come back to haunt these guys.
Right. And you never know, a guy could come back and have a bad year, right?
Sure.
So and hurt his value that way. But it does seem like with those players, and Rousseau was a really interesting one. To me, because again, he was so good for one season, and plus he's like 6'7", 200. I mean, he's one of those guys that you look at and you think, wow, that guy could be amazing. You know, he's also kind of a late bloomer as far as football goes. If I remember reading up on his background, like I seem to remember there was like a lot of tight end, wide receiver, and oh my God, all of a sudden like he grew and he became a defensive end. So he's sort of the typical late bloomer, and you do wonder if one more year to sort of just establish, okay, this is who you are. Maybe you're not even like another 15 sack guy, but if you just establish one more year of baseline who you are, it would have helped him and maybe some of these other players.
No doubt about it. No, I 100% agree with you on that one. He played receiver in high school and looked like, you know, Dorial Green Beckham almost. So he's this big, tall, you know, kid with a lot of girth, but girth for a receiver, not for a kid who occasionally played nose tackle, right? I mean, that's the amazing part of what he did in 19. But, yeah, I still struggle with his evaluation because it's a small sample size. He still looked a little raw at times on the outside, but man, that ceiling would be pretty high, I think.
So you open the door then to the evaluation of positions, the defensive tackle. And yeah, I kind of got that in the listen. I don't study this stuff like you do, and I am not a scout. I always try to make that caveat to people.
Yeah, me
like,
too.
I got out of that business, but even like at least you're like down in the weeds talking
right.
to people about this. When I am very much observational, and I'll talk mm-hmm. to some, certainly talk to some coaches to try to get some opinions and ideas of where things are going draft potential wise. But I'm not in this deep down the weeds like you are, and I'm definitely not looking at things like a scout. That said, all those caveats thrown out, when I look at the board, I find myself thinking, yeah, defensive tackle, Barmore, Levi Onwuzurike from Washington. That's about it for what I think would be possible first rounders. And as you also mentioned, there's no super elite edge guy because those are the guys who tend to be near the top of the first round. So generally speaking, if the D tackle is a little light, give me a little more broader picture of the D end than the edge rushers. Because again, those are guys who tend to shoot up when they're top tier talents. They shoot up the draft boards. But this year it looks like a lot of guys who have had one or two good years but still have some holes to fill on their resume.
Yeah, perfectly said. I mean, that really is, I think, the big picture at this position, right? I mean, I really was excited watching Jalen Phillips come back from kind of flaming out at UCLA and then may have been the best edge player in the country down the stretch. Last 6-7 games, he was terrific. And, you know, there are some medical concerns. He retired at one point for concussions. There's some off-the-field stuff that needs to be cleared up. But he might be your best talent there. Do you take him in the top 10? I wouldn't. Azeez Ojulari, undersized guy, but the disruption was there. Almost 10 sacks, 4 forced fumbles, you know, can play on his feet. But again, not going to be a scheme fit for every team. That probably puts him out of the top 10 or 15. You know, Quiddy Pay from Michigan, Jason Owe from Penn State, you know, great workout players whose production hasn't always matched their traits. You know, the kid who's gotten a little bit of a buzz lately has been Joe Tryon, Onwuzurike's teammate at Washington. But another kind of raw, toolsy player, Joseph Osai, same idea, where you say to yourself, you know, in 3 years, could they be a Pro Bowler? Sure. 3 years, could they be looking for work? Absolutely. So there really is a lot of volatility at that. And there is no surefire, no questions asked. You know, even when the Raiders took Cleveland Farrell at four, and it was considered a big reach, like he was one of those players with like a super high floor. And I think everybody felt pretty good about, okay, you're getting something with this guy. And I don't know that you could say that about a ton of players at this position.
Mm-hmm. Owe is an interesting one to me because he didn't have a sack last year,
right?
Which has to, in some ways, be a red flag. But I also know that that was a player I had eyes on a lot last year for whatever reason. I ended up watching a lot of Penn State games,
yeah.
And I always found myself thinking, that guy is in the backfield all the time. So I guess that's a broader way. That's a backdoor way of me asking you. Production and value of stats and especially at this position, but maybe you can branch it out to all positions. In other words, what is the value of a sack? What is the value of stats, especially at these defensive positions?
Yeah, and there are certain teams, like for instance the Baltimore Ravens. They've had a lot of continuity on their staff, and Ozzie Newsome to Eric DaCosta, and a lot of those guys have stayed and turned down other jobs because they like the environment. And they're a strong NFL program, so. You know, they put a little bit more emphasis in sack production. They feel like if you're getting sacks in college, that is going to translate to the NFL. Then there are other teams who take the approach that you just made, which is Jason Owe against Indiana must have been in the backfield 10 times. You know, I mean, he was always getting penetration, just missing sacks, getting quarterback hits, being disruptive. So sacks could be overrated if you don't know how to sort of use the data and make sure you understand. I mean, did you luck your way into the sack? Did somebody else do all the work and you just cleaned up the mess? Or are you the one causing the disruption? So that's why I feel like Owe has a chance, because he's I called him the one percenter of 1% athletes. Like, he is that rare. But yeah, I think for edge rushers, sack production can be wildly misleading. For as impressive as Rousseau's, 15.5 sacks were, I would argue that the tape for Owe in 2020 was maybe a little bit more encouraging. I mean, I know that sounds crazy to say, but that can, you can look at it that way and not be wrong, I guess. So that I would say of all the positions that require that are sort of stat driven, sacks and edge rushers, you think of Danielle Hunter and other guys who did nothing in college in terms of sacks, but became beasts in the NFL. There are always examples of guys who kind of belie the numbers.
So let's move over to what I think is a deeper position. I'll get your opinion on this, and that's corner. Now,
yes.
Though, again, it seems like Patrick Surtain seems to be the consensus number one here, and he looks like a guy who is just who seems like has what you would call a high floor, right? It seems like he's, as a corner, a guy who's less likely to bust. But then again, I also don't see – the NFL loves corners. My goodness, it loves corners, and it drafts corners in bulk, right?
That's right.
There seems to be a whole glut of them that would be end of the first round and into the second round. Am I reading that position right?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, that, let's say that Surtain and Horn go in the top 15. I mean, I feel pretty good about that, but let's just assume they go in the top half of the round. After that, you have Greg Newsome from Northwestern. He had a great season, has been hurt 3 years in a row. That worries you a little. Caleb Farley, we mentioned multiple back procedures, new to the position, looked amazing in 2019 at times. I got to see him up close against Chase Claypool in Notre Dame. Really liked him. But, the health concerns. He also had an ACL his freshman year. So that pushes him into that end of first, late second. Asante Samuel Jr., bloodlines, playmaking ability was on display. Lack of size. Is he a nickel? Those are the same questions that keep him in that kind of 25 to 45 range. I think you can go down the line with the next four or five corners. And, would it stun me if somebody saw, that one of the Georgia kids, Eric Stokes or Tyson Campbell, and used a, late first or high second round pick on them? No, because that's what you want your corners to look like. Does the tape tell a story that maybe there's some development needed? Sure. Kelvin Joseph at Kentucky. There's a lot of guys in this draft who might have the talent to go higher, but because of one major or two major questions, kind of get pushed down into that range that you're talking about, either late first, you know, I would say all the way maybe to the mid or late second round. But yeah, it's a deep position. You're absolutely right about that. And I think we'll see some surprising performers from even day three come out of this group.
Yeah, so that's why I bring that up to point out to people who are watching the draft. You know, there's going to be a guy picked toward the end of the first round, and there's going to be this sort of like, oh, I didn't think that guy was going to be a first rounder.
Right.
And but really, the difference between the guys who are quote unquote first rounders, you know, the number 27 pick and the number 34 pick is just one team. One team says what you said. And Tyson Campbell, I think, is a perfect example because he struck me as the guy, again, my untrained eye. I've seen him play, and I thought that guy looks everything like what you want your first round corner to be. He's sort of tall and rangy. And I know, you know, the NFL is not, they love corners, and they especially love tall corners. And that's always been the guy. Like, his production wasn't necessarily great, but I find myself thinking, like, I could see somebody fall in love with that guy and him being, you know, again, I don't know who's drafting 28, but him being the guy who gets drafted 28 or 27 or 29, and people are going, wow, that's a little bit of a reach. I didn't expect that. But in reality, not really all that much different between 28 and 37.
I agree. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, it's always a traits over production league as a whole. I mean, right, it doesn't always work out that way. But and cornerback is one of those positions where if you see 32-inch arms or longer, if you see 6 foot or taller, if you see a guy who's in that 200-pound range and they run somewhere around a 4.4, like these are just the you know, the athletic measures or whatever, people get excited, right? I mean, there's a day three corner from BYU, Chris Wilcox, who, you know, if he hadn't been hurt, he looks the perfect part, and he's still going to go despite all these major health concerns. He's still probably going to be a fourth or fifth round pick. And so, you know, I pick him out as an example because you do find Richard Shermans out there. You do find those players who, you know, have all the traits. They're maybe raw at the position. They were playing another spot, or they were on offense in high school or what have you. They move over to corner and something just clicks. So yeah, that's a spot where I absolutely think there, and edge rusher and offensive tackle, you see it a lot where if you check off three or four boxes for size and athleticism, even if the tape doesn't match up, you're probably getting a pretty good spot.
Okay, I saved the quarterbacks because I wanted people to hang on here for the quarterback discussion. Make them wait a little bit. Though to a certain degree, I also saved the quarterbacks because we talk so much about them that I also sometimes wonder if people are tired of talking of hearing about them.
Yeah, of course.
But there are five of them here. And the question I wanted to ask you that I found myself thinking a lot about, just a few years back, 2017, if I got the year right, five quarterbacks were taken in the first round. Mm-hmm. It was Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, not necessarily in this order. Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, Josh Allen, and Lamar Jackson.
Yeah. Yep.
I want you to take that group and sort of as a whole, do you compare them to this year's group, which includes Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, mm-hmm. Trey Lance, Zach Wilson, and Mac Jones. We're pretty sure that those five are going to go in the first round.
Yeah.
I know maybe it's a little apples to oranges, but how do you feel about that 2017 group compared to this group?
Yeah. Is this the awkward point where I admit that I had Josh Rosen above Josh Allen? I don't know. I may be, but
you know what? The funny thing. Oh, so here I'll make it again. I'm with you on this. I remember selling Rosen as maybe the best one of that group. To a lot of people, I really thought very highly of Rosen, and he ended up being the biggest flame out of all too. So, you know, no, I'm with you on this. You and me, buddy, we're in this one together.
I'm glad I have a partner in crime here. Yeah. I mean, I believe I had them ranked, and I'd have to sort of scroll through my header a little bit, but I think I had them ranked Baker first, Lamar second. I was willing to take a chance on the talent. And I just sort of felt like, if used correctly, you know, he could be really special. Rosen third, Darnold fourth, and Josh Allen fifth. And with Allen, I mean, it was, you know, it was almost like what we're doing with Trey Lance, which is just saying, wow, he's really impressive. But boy, you know, there's some hangups here. But I would say I probably would have Trevor Lawrence as the top guy. You know, do I think he's a perfect prospect? No, but I would still put him number one. And then I would probably have Justin Fields, Trey Lance, and Baker Mayfield all really close. I think I would have had them. I'm trying to remember the exact draft grades I gave them at the time, but I'm guessing they were right about the same point. You know, Baker's production was great and he ran the ball. I knew that he wouldn't be able to scramble quite as much and, you know, had some room to grow as a pocket passer, but I still liked him a lot. And I felt like those three probably would have been on the same level with Lamar, maybe in a tier of his own. And then I would have had Zach Wilson, you know, Sam Darnold, Josh Rosen, that group, and then Josh Allen and Mac Jones in the bottom tier, if you will. So it sounds a little backward now because obviously I got it wrong on Rosen and got it wrong on Allen for different reasons. And I'm lower on Zach Wilson than other people.
I was going to say, okay, so I'm a Jets fan. You're going to have to talk me off the ledge here that you just pushed me out on, because I was all in on Zach Wilson. I constantly am trying to make myself all in on Zach Wilson, even though I have seen a lot of Justin Fields, and oh boy, I like what that looks like too.
Yeah.
But I have sold myself on Zach Wilson, who I did really love watching during the season. He's a fun player to watch. So, all right, Eric, tell me why you like Fields pick over Zach Wilson.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, Zach Wilson was my favorite quarterback to watch. Just to sit back and, you know, grab some popcorn and just be like, okay, what kind of, you know, crazy stuff is he going to pull out today against Texas State and, you know, Boise State and whoever. And again, he's still the guy making those throws. And the degree of difficulty on some of these plays was absurd. There's that natural tendency to say, wow, he's got some Aaron Rodgers. He's got some Patrick Mahomes. Sure, but he's not either one of those guys. I'm not ready to say that. And I still have him in my top, I don't know what, 11, 12 overall. I mean, I'm not knocking the guy to the point where I wouldn't use a high pick on him. I'm just saying that there are other quarterbacks in this class that I have a little bit more affinity for. So I think the injury concerns that cropped up in 2019 go along with his small build and that style where, you know, he took some sacks he didn't need to take. He had, for the most part, great protection in front of him. He may not have that unless you find four other Mekhi Becktons, right? I mean, so there are some worries about how the scheme and an NFL type of offense will fit him. Then again, that staff came from the 49ers. Kyle Shanahan's steeped concepts, you know, bootleg, outside zone, play action, you know, work off that. That's really where he thrives, in my opinion, outside the pocket, creating, making things out of nothing, essentially. So I do think he's landing in the good spot, and he's a competitor. He can hold up to the New York, glare. So there are a lot of things to like. I just wonder if maybe we overrated his phenomenal 2020 season just a hair, and if there aren't a few questions about his durability and whether he can get away with some of those plays.
Right. I think to a certain degree, you got a guy like him who had an amazing, and he was sort of the new thing, right? We all sort of felt cool about discovering Zach Wilson, even though we really didn't discover him. While Justin Fields almost becomes a victim of what we've been talking about and seeing, we see him every week on for playing for Ohio State. And even though he only played 2 years, he was also a mega prospect going back to Trevor Lawrence's year, and whether he was going to play at Georgia was a big deal. So I do wonder if there's a certain fatigue that comes in to the guys who we see more often or whose story we know a little better. Now, you mentioned the 49ers. Are they going to take Mac Jones? That's a thing that's going to happen, isn't it, Eric?
I think so, but, you know, anytime Vegas sort of strongly disagrees, you know, the betting odds say that Justin Fields is your prohibitive favorite there. Look, you know, I wish I had intel. I've asked. I've tried to reach out and say, all right, who are you guys taking? And, you know, they're keeping it close to the vest. I don't believe they made that trade without having a pretty darn good idea who they were targeting, right? I doubt there's a situation where they're like, well, you know, Fields, you know, Wilson, Mac, we'll take any of them. You know, the Jets may have done that with Sam Darnold when that trade happened a little bit, sort of. They moved up blindly, but I don't believe the 49ers did in this case. I think they had a good idea who their old buddy Robert Saleh was taking it to. I think they knew, obviously, Trevor was going one. So I think they moved up to that three spot knowing exactly who'd be available and exactly who they preferred prior to these pro day workouts. So yeah, it when I showed my mock draft, my right after that trade happened, I put Trey Lance there, and I just thought, boy, you trade 2 first-round picks to move up 9 spots, you're probably going for the guy with the high upside, right? You know, and so I showed it to 3 teams, 2 of them not named 49ers. 2 of them said, our understanding or our thinking is that Mac Jones is going to be there at 3. And I said, wow. And then all of a sudden, you know, it kind of mushroomed from there. So yeah, that was a little surprising to hear, but kind of like what I was saying with Wilson and the Jets, like he fits in that offense. If they do what they did in San Francisco, I think Mac can really do well in Shanahan's system in the sense that he's a facilitator and Kyle loves his offense. Like he loves his playbook. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, he has, conviction, but he wants a guy to run his playbook. And Jimmy didn't always do that and couldn't always do that. So, I don't know what this says for Garoppolo. I don't know if Mac's going to end up being the right pick, but it certainly makes sense from that aspect.
So let me ask you for an evaluation of Mac Jones, because Mac Jones had a fabulous, he had a better year than Tua. Right. He was better than Tua, and Tua went number 5, and that was after major hip surgery. But I can't help but keep going back to this, and it's a very oversimplified evaluation of quarterbacks. We are now in an era where often, and it's amazing it took the NFL this long to think of it or to be down with this theory, but we're essentially going to take one of the best athletes, if not the best athlete on the field, and make him the quarterback, right?
Yep.
Like, it's amazing that you and I are about the same age, that we watched decades of football where that wasn't the thing that they did, right? Like, why would you not make the best athlete and just teach him how to throw and make that the quarterback? And that's why you have the Josh Allens of the world and the Lamar Jacksons. And again, all these wondrous Patrick Mahomes athletes who are also tremendous quarterbacks. And I look at Mac Jones and I think he is a 1995 quarterback. Like, he's not a particularly great athlete. That's not to say he's going to fall over and he's uncoordinated, but he's not a top tier athlete. He seems to be sort of limited in terms of his arm strength and arm talent, however you want to define that. So that's my reading on Mac Jones. It's just that this doesn't seem like quarterback 2021, and he's going to go, because even Daniel Jones, who was a stretch a couple of years ago, again, there was always that feeling of like, well, there's an athleticism here that just hasn't been tapped into. Am I missing that with Mac Jones? I said, this doesn't seem like the quarterback that goes 3 overall in 2021. This seems like the quarterback that goes 3 overall in 2001, maybe.
Right. Yeah, right. Like the Brad Johnson type quarterback who can, win you a Super Bowl in the perfect setting, right? If you have a championship defense and a couple playmakers beside you, right? I mean, that's this overall sense that I got to. I did feel like, his athleticism, his pro day workout was pretty good. Like, he actually ran faster and jumped higher than I think a lot of people realize.
There you go.
He's got the tennis background. He moves pretty well in the pocket. All those things are perhaps a little bit undersold. So, that said, I'm with you on the big hole. I mean, even though he connected on a lot of deep passes, they were the rainbow variety. They were the ones that dropped in the bucket and great touch and everything. But can he thread the deep out? I mean, can he just rip the ball into a tight window and get it through the way Josh Allen can? No, that's not his game. And I think he knows that. He's got good self-awareness. But yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm writing a story for Friday just about the same topic, basically. And, it is funny how the old school kind of did get validated a little bit with Tom Brady winning a Super Bowl and Mac Jones winning a national title and beating 2 sort of prolific dual threat quarterbacks along the way, but how long is that going to last? And you're right, in more cases than not, those exciting, alluring traits and the belief that they have more ability to create is always going to be more alluring these days than it ever has.
I think you'll bury yourself looking for the next Tom Brady, right?
Exactly.
I don't know if you like looking for the next greatest quarterback of all time who plays until he's 43. Like, that's an anomaly that you should not be looking for as you're trying to draft. But I do think, listen, And I'm sure Mac Jones gets this because a lot of, quite frankly, white quarterbacks get that, right? Like, oh,
yeah,
is
sure.
he as athletic as we think? He's sneaky fast, quote unquote. Though I will defend myself in saying, like, listen, like Sam Darnold was not sneaky athletic. He was very athletic. And Josh Allen, like, I remember like going to write a story on Josh Allen when he was at Wyoming. And we were sort of unwrapping the present that was Josh Allen and thinking, oh, my God, this guy is just a freak of an athlete. Like, so again, like, you know, sometimes we use that athlete as something of, you know, code. That has not been the case with some of these other guys coming through. Josh Allen was far more advanced athletically than he was refined, and it's that athleticism that has made him a special quarterback because now he has become refined. Is that what Trey Lance essentially is? Sort of is he? You know, we talked about the Allen Trey Lance comparison. Is he this just bundle of great talent and athleticism that just needs to be refined? Because I've also heard people tell me, and again, I haven't seen him play very much, that even though he's playing against lower competition, he seems to have a pretty good grasp of what he's doing out there, maybe even more so than some of the guys that we're talking about, you know, the Wilsons and the Fields being drafted ahead of him.
Yeah, I agree with that part too. I mean, I think, you know, Zach Wilson clearly has a, you know, high confidence in his game. And I think Justin Fields, you know, doesn't, you know, the Clemson game is a great example of him, you know, understanding where the ball needs to go and all that. It's not knocking their football instincts. But Trey Lance, I mean, for a guy who was, you know, sort of turned down to play quarterback by PJ Fleck and other coaches, right? I mean, we pick on PJ because he's in state, but there were plenty of other coaches in the Midwest who didn't think that, you know, that he could do anything but be an athlete. For a guy that underwent that stigma, you and I talked to a couple of different, you know, quarterback coaches and people who watched him. They said, you know, Eric, he's changing protections at the line as a redshirt freshman in a complex offense. This is, you know, this is a great system up there that's produced two NFL quarterbacks in Carson Wentz and Easton Stick. And they ask a lot of their quarterbacks. They had to win the battle, and he was making adjustments at the line. He was communicating out there. He was doing all the things. He seemed to know where the ball needed to go. He didn't always put it exactly where it needed to go, but he had the right idea on what the passing concepts were and what the coverages were. So from that standpoint, I'd say he's pretty advanced mentally speaking. And that's what's so exciting, is because he's also this sort of Steve McNair build, you know, this big, thick kid who can throw it a mile and a half, but also, you know, rumble through a couple touchdowns and beat you to the corner and score that way. So he's so exciting, but also such a difficult evaluation because of the lack of tape and the level of competition.
Just give me a very quick, where do you have Lance being? Because it sounds like you do have, you're down with the idea that Mac Jones will be number three. So where do you have Lance going, and where do you have Fields going?
Yeah, I mean, the first spot would be number four for either one of those guys if Atlanta trades out. The feeling I'm getting is that the Falcons probably aren't going to stay there and take a quarterback. Yes, they've put on a good show and been at all the pro days. Yes, Matt Ryan's 35 or 6, but I still don't think that's the direction they're going. So I would guess a trade down or, you know, Kyle Pitts or something. Then you start asking, who's moving up? Or does Detroit, the Lions at 7, do they want to replace Jared Goff after a year? Did they take on Goff's salary to get those draft picks? So it starts at 4, and I think it goes up to the Broncos pick at number 9, and there could be some trade activity, maybe multiple trades. But, you know, as to who goes first, I'm not sure. I would say I think Fields, but now I'm starting to doubt that based on it's going to be a team by team preference. There's no consensus right now.
And I'm fairly confident that by the time we get to number 10, all the quarterbacks will be gone, because that would be amazing if we had 5 out of the first 10 picks, or really conceivably 5 out of the first 9. That would be pretty incredible. That would be unprecedented.
It would be set a record. It would be, I think we had 6 and 83, but in the first round, right? And that would include the last pick of the round. But I don't believe we've ever had 5 in the top 10. So yeah, if that happens, I mean, look, I don't think there's any way any of them get by New England at 15. So I suspect there's a good chance that the 5 and 10 thing could happen. And that would be, you know, set a record. And the question is, was it the right move? Do they, you know, are these guys worth it? And only time will tell, I guess.
Okay, I don't want to keep you too much longer, Eric, but I do want to hit a little bit of the rest of the offense. And just let's put it this way. What is the, and I think I know where this is going, but it's because it's related to the cornerbacks. What's the deepest position on the offensive side?
Yeah, you're right. It's wide receiver, yeah. I think. And offensive tackle would be a good one. I mean, I really like this group and think there's some – it's not as top-heavy as last year. We had four in the first 14 picks, but the depth of this tackle group is good. But the wide receivers are really strong, kind of, you know, if not top to bottom, I would say better at the top and deeper than last year. And last year was a fantastic class. So, you know, I think there's going to be let me think. I mean, a dozen guys in this year's group who get, you know, notable action right away, you know, wow. Either starting or as the third wide out or, you know, in sub packages or stuff like that. So, and then another dozen beyond that who are, you know, potential starters. That's a really great, deep group. I know that doesn't sound like a ton, but, you know, Ja'Marr Chase looks like a number one. Jalen Waddle could be Tyreek Hill. You know, Devontae Smith, doubt him if you want, but you know, you saw what he did last year. I mean, sure. He's going to be something in this league. So I think that trio right there is better than Henry Ruggs, CeeDee Lamb, Jerry Jeudy. Not by a ton, but I think a little better overall. And then you get into all these sort of smaller playmaking guys like Eli Moore and, you know, Kadarius Toney and you know, Dyami Brown is a deep guy. And then some of the bigger ones, the freakier guys like Terrace Marshall and you know, I like this group. I really think that in day three, you'll get, you know, a couple of future starters and good contributors as well. So
remember, and a good thing to remember. So last year, you mentioned the top three of Ruggs, Jeudy, and CeeDee Lamb. The best player ended up being Justin Jefferson, who ended up going about 18 or 19. So I think
that could happen again. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that you might end up seeing, and I get your opinion on this, is, you know, because there are so many and they sort of all have good traits and interesting and maybe in some ways are a little interchangeable, I guess there's also a possibility you could see a few of them slip, right? You could see a couple of teams that decide, you know what, we're not going to go wide receiver at 14 or 15 or whatever. And again, I don't have the board in front of me, but maybe we'll wait until our second round because we think that there are three guys almost as good as this potential first rounder.
Yeah, if you told me that, you know, Rashad Bateman or Terrace Marshall or, you know, even like a Nico Collins from Michigan, another opt-out guy who went to the Senior Bowl and played well, like, you know, if you told me that each of them went, you know, 15 to 20 picks lower than you expected, but ended up being one of the best receivers in this group, it wouldn't stun me. Because I think you're right, that the amount of depth in this class, the fact that we had a deep wide receiver group last year, there were some big names in free agency that changed position or changed teams at that position. It wouldn't stun me at all to see a first round prospect go late round two or a second round prospect even creep into the early parts of round four. It happens. And this year's of all years, it could happen more easily.
Okay. Last one. And this is a deep dive. We're going to go for the folks who are draft nicks who really like to geek out. Who give me one, two, I don't know, just however many you want to rattle off of your day three guys who are you look at as day three picks, and not necessarily because they get the highest grade, but just because I like this prospect. There's something about this guy that makes me think that even though I have him graded X, I think that this is a guy who's going to play a long time in the NFL. Maybe not be a superstar, but this is a guy who's going to play a long time in the NFL.
Yeah, good question. One name that pops to mind, you know, he was somebody that I saw, you know, relatively early in the season, knew about coming into the year, but didn't really go deep on, was Peyton Turner, the defensive end from Houston. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of an impressive looking kid and had, you know, just sort of jotted his name down. And, you know, I put him as sort of a, you know, third, fourth round guy in my head without asking anybody. But as the season went on, the buzz on him started to grow. And his stats weren't amazing. But the more you watched him, the more you gain an appreciation for his sort of athletic twitch and all that, his length. And the fact that he's, you know, he was like a 215-pound athlete when he got to Houston. They just said, we're going to put him on defense. We'll figure out what to do with him. And they bulked him up and made him into a darn good player, you know. And, you know, he sort of came out as Ed Oliver moved on. So he's you know, he hasn't been doing it with a ton of talent around him. And he's one that I wouldn't be shocked that he outplays his draft status. And another one would be Elijah Molden, the nickel back from Washington. And boy, he's just a fun little player. I don't know that he's going to be, you know, Tyrann Mathieu or Buda Baker, one of those little sort of mighty might 5'9" do it all guys, but he's not far off. Like, he's not fast, not big, but his playing temperament is just special to me. And I think he'll just be one of those guys who will look back in 10 years and say, how did that dude go 73rd? You know what I mean? Right, like, or right. Whatever. I feel like he'll end up being one of the, you know, 40 or 50 best players in this class easily.
Eric Edholm is the draft analyst reporter for Yahoo Sports. Does a great job there. And one of the other projects that you put together with your teammates there at Yahoo Sports, Charles Robinson, and my friend Pete Thamel, who covers college football and does such a great job, is the All Juice team. And Eric, frankly, I'm just going to let you take over from here to describe what the All Juice team is and why it was sort of a special project for you this year because of who you did it for.
Yeah, Therese Paylor, our former colleague, he was covering the Chiefs for a few years in Kansas City, earned a real local following there, you know, beloved writer, I would say, came over to Yahoo in 2018 and brought with him the All Juice team, which was based on three sort of pillars: effort, attitude, performance. He wanted to pluck out the draft prospects, and he loved the draft. He was a draft geek through and through, football geek in general, grinded on tape. But he wanted to find the guys, not just the first rounders, like, you know, two from the first, two from the second, two from the third. He would spread it out, even get some undrafted guys, 22 players, 11 on each side, who had that chip on their shoulder, the grit, the sort of the underdogs, the guy with a little dirt under their fingernails, but also the explosive playmaking ability and you know, some of those things that make them NFL prospects. So it was an annual read. It was a must read. It was a great product he put out. Therese died back on February 9th, right after the Super Bowl, stunned us all. He was supposed to have a 2-week vacation. You know, he died in his sleep, and it just, you know, he's 37 years old, Ralph, and it just, you know, it shook all of us. And we all just decided that first day we heard the news, we're doing the Juice team in Therese's honor. We got a scholarship going at Howard University, his alma mater. Wall Street Journal's involved, Kansas City Star is involved, Yahoo Sports is involved. Check out the hoodies. You're going to want the hoodies or the T-shirts, the All Juice team. We've got them up there to benefit. 100% of the proceeds go to the Therese Paylor Scholarship at Howard to help a young journalist gain some help on their way to becoming a writer, because Therese was a self-made man. I mean, he came up through the ranks and became this sort of larger-than-life figure, and we miss him very dearly.
Well, I'm glad I can do a very small part in helping you get the word out on that, because, again, I didn't know Therese, but when he passed, the outpouring was remarkable, and you could tell that he was a very special human being. And so, again, I'm glad you continued his work. It's the All Juice team. You can find it on Yahoo Sports. I'll even link to it in the show notes here if you want to read up with it. Eric Edholm, again, thank you so much for doing this today, providing some great insight. We're going to try to get you back to this podcast a little more often, I think.
Sure. Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. And go draft.
And now 3 and Out, first down. I'd like to thank European Soccer for inadvertently providing us college football writers some off-season content. I was among those who noticed that the proposed Super League had a college football feel to it, insofar as it was a small group of teams working with their best interest in mind, not necessarily the best interest of the sport as a whole, and that there is a massive gap between the haves and have-nots in that sport, and the haves have the power to manipulate the structure so they stay haves. Sounds pretty familiar, right? So, of course, I wrote a column and picked my own college football Super League. I thought the only particularly controversial pick was my inclusion of UCLA, because I wanted to have three West Coast teams to balance the country and give me ample opportunities to slot a game in the late Eastern time zone. I'll link the column in the show notes, but I came very close to including Nebraska instead of UCLA, and I also came pretty close to including both Nebraska and UCLA and instead leaving out LSU. A couple of my colleagues talked me out of not including LSU, which would have drawn a few more clicks, but wouldn't have really been a smart decision. The one I'd probably reconsider if I had to do the exercise all over again was Auburn. Big rivalry games have a ton of value to media rights holders. People will watch the Iron Bowl with no connection to the Iron Bowl because it is the Iron Bowl, and folks know that brand. The same goes for Ohio State-Michigan or the Red River Shootout between Texas and Oklahoma. Preserving the Alabama-Auburn rivalry convinced me to include Auburn. But as one of my Twitter followers pointed out, if you're going to start a 15-team Super League in college football, I think it's safe to say you have pretty much abandoned any thought of preserving tradition. While I do think a restructuring of Division I is much needed and likely to happen over the next decade or so, I think the Power Five will choose to stay tethered in some way to the rest of FBS. I don't think the middle and second division teams in the Power Five conferences are ready to sign up for a world in which they play, I don't know, let's say 10 conference games and nothing but other Power Five schools. In that scenario, there would be a lot of teams that would be resigning themselves to a world in which they rarely have winning seasons. Second down, one of the more interesting quarterbacks on the transfer market has reportedly found a home. Joe Milton, who left Michigan after last season, is headed to Tennessee, according to Pete Thamel of Yahoo Sports. The Vols have been a quarterback black hole in recent years, even when they bring in some highly touted recruits such as Jarrett Garantano. Josh Heupel inherited a roster with three quarterbacks who expected to compete for the job in Harrison Bailey, Brian Maurer, and Virginia Tech transfer Hendon Hooker. This appears to be Heupel not only adding another option, but adding his guy to the mix. Milton was recruited by Heupel when he was OC at Missouri before he became the head coach at UCF. The move has not become official yet because Milton is still, I believe, finishing up classes at Michigan as he tries to graduate. But you can't help but wonder if Milton coming to Knoxville triggers the players who are there to reassess whether they should stay. Remember, everybody gets to transfer one time as an undergraduate without sitting out now after the NCAA voted for that reform last week. And because it was voted on so late in the cycle, the date to inform schools of a transfer for this year only in football is July 1st. I have no inside info about what the Vols quarterback room is doing, but conventional wisdom suggests at least one of those guys who competed to start in the spring will be at another school come fall. Third down. Speaking of transferring quarterbacks, I want to circle around to a topic I hit on Twitter at the end of last week. Without just reading my own tweets, which sounds kind of pretentious, the point I was trying to make is that coaches and fans and even media need to stop ascribing virtue to not transferring. There tends to be this default to use the fact that a player was willing to stick around as proof that that player has high character, that he stuck it out through adversity when other players would have bailed and taken the quote-unquote easy way out. I believe that whole narrative is broken. Choosing to remain a backup rather than transfer for a potentially better opportunity is neither virtuous nor misguided. It's just a personal decision that has a lot of other variables involved. So, of course, someone on my timeline pointed out Jalen Hurts staying at Alabama for a season after he lost the starting job to Tua Tagovailoa. This person said, "Why shouldn't we celebrate Jalen for staying when he could have left?" To which I say, what exactly are we celebrating? Just to be clear, it's fine by me. Stay, go, it's all good. Figure out your path and do what's best for you. Hurts decided to stay because he decided he wanted to graduate from Alabama. So, that's fine. Good decision for him. I assume he really liked his teammates and liked his life at Alabama. Hurts himself has never really revealed that much about what went into his decision. But if you think back to 2018, when he made that decision, getting a waiver to become immediately eligible after transferring was sort of a new thing. Shea Patterson was the first high-profile case when he went from Ole Miss to Michigan, and it was resolved in late April of that year. Players were still operating under the assumption that they would have to sit out a season after transferring unless they had graduated. So I can't imagine that Hurts was seeing a ton of benefit in leaving Alabama just to go to another school and sit out the 2018 season. Now, it would have been interesting if Hurts had been facing that same decision in the spring of 2019 after Justin Fields had received his waiver to play immediately at Ohio State. Also, remember, when Hurts decided to play out 2018 as a backup, it was coming on the heels of Kelly Bryant leaving Clemson after four games when he was replaced as a starter by Trevor Lawrence. All that's to say, I understand why Hurts staying and then bailing out the Tide in the SEC title game when Tua was hurt was a big story. Of course it was a big story. Hurts made a decision that bucked the trend. But because fans, and frankly, lots of people who cover sports, like to romanticize these things, Hurts was lauded for his loyalty and perseverance in a way that might not have truly matched the reality of that situation. That's the show for today. I'd like to thank my new producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you'd like to get your pods. Please subscribe so you do not miss an episode. If you have questions that you'd like me or my guest to answer, email them to aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. That's aptop25, the numbers 25, mailbag@gmail.com. I think we're going to get some emails fairly soon on the show. Have a pretty good big one that we might do an entire show, as we've done in the past, on the future of college football. Might not be next week, but because I think we might do some more draft stuff next week, but maybe the week after that. Again, we'd love to hear from you on all topics college football, serious and silly. That's aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.